This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner. Bob Woodward knows a thing or two about Washington, D.C. He's been writing about politics and power since the 70s, when he and Carl Bernstein broke the Watergate story. His latest book, his 17th, takes the reader inside the Obama White House during last summer's debt ceiling crisis. Yes, the one that almost tipped the country and the financial markets into economic catastrophe. The book is called The Price of Politics. Mr. Woodward, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
One White House aide you interviewed for your book said that during the final days of the debt ceiling crisis, it felt like the financial equivalent of the Cuban Missile Crisis. After you finished all your reporting, did you conclude the same thing?
Yes. And not only that, was it at the time in 2011 somewhat like an economic Cuban Missile Crisis, but as you know, we're going to face the same problems come December, January of next year, where the government is not going to have the authority from the Congress to pay its bills. And we borrow about $1 trillion more than we spend each year. And so the rubber is going to meet the road again, and we're going to have some sort of crisis unless the White House and the Republicans can work out a way to avoid it.
You've been reporting on Washington's, let's call them movers and shakers, for a long time. I was curious if anyone told you anything in the course of these interviews that really took you by surprise, that took you aback, where, you know, you as a Washington journalist just said, whoa, I can't believe that happened.
Well, there are all kinds of things in the book that show the fundamental disagreements and the attitudes and the hostilities. I guess one of the most interesting incidents was after President Obama proposed to Speaker Boehner that they add more revenue to the deal they were trying to work out last summer. And Boehner called Eric Cantor, who's the number two House Republican, the majority leader, in a sense, Boehner's executive officer, called Eric Cantor and his chief of staff down to consult on this issue. And Eric Cantor's chief of staff asked the speaker, how many votes do you think you would get with a revenue figure in this case of $1.2 trillion, and Boehner said about 170 votes, and the chief of staff to Eric Cantor said, "You're crazy." Something not polite, something really kind of unheard of when you have a staffer on the Hill tell the Speaker of the House that he's crazy. Turned out that there was no way Cantor or Boehner were going to be able to get the votes to increase a revenue proposal to that level.
Yeah. Talk about President Obama for a minute, because the overall picture that readers will get, I think, from your book is a president who is overly confident, who's sort of a clumsy negotiator, and who doesn't really like Congress that much and doesn't really want to deal with them. Is that the impression you wanted to leave the reader with?
Well, what I've done is reported it. Take Larry Summers, well known to your listeners. He was Treasury Secretary for Clinton, was Obama's chief economic advisor in the White House for the first 2 years, and Summers concluded that not only was there this disconnect that Obama had with people, but that in terms of the leaders in Congress, he really didn't like them. And it's quite evident that he doesn't spend enough time with them to kind of close a deal or at least a personal relationship so they can negotiate. There is a wall, there is a distance, and in fact, I think on the president's part, a dislike.
And some exasperation on the part of people in Congress. There's this key scene in your book, right, where congressional leaders and the president are in the room as as the debt ceiling deadline looms, and they sort of kick him out, don't they?
Yes. Again, this was quite surprising. The president, when his new revenue offer was rejected by the speaker, the president called Speaker Boehner and the Democratic leaders, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, to the White House for an 11 o'clock Saturday morning meeting. The congressional leaders had been negotiating themselves, and Harry Reid, again, the Democratic leader, supposedly somebody who's going to go along with the president's will, asked the president to leave the meeting in the cabinet room of the White House that the president had called because they wanted to talk, the congressional leaders, and they were working out their deal. I asked the president about this because I was a little skeptical, and he confirmed that it happened and said he was not going to stand on protocol. If they wanted him out of the room, he was going to go, and he did exit, but it shows that they didn't figure a way to cut a deal. And you cut deals, as everyone knows, by compromising, by giving a little here, taking a little there. And the Republicans, you need to understand this, are kind of a brick wall on a lot of these issues and were absolutely adamant to not raise taxes one bit under any circumstances. And so Boehner's kind of workaround was to say, well, we'll raise revenue, we'll have some sort of serious tax reform where we will cut deductions and in so doing lower the rate and wind up getting more revenue. Now, this can happen, but it's really hard, and I kind of call it the great white whale in the pursuit of some sort of tax reform.
Yeah. But sort of a true power moment, right? It's sort of a little bit of a mini power struggle in that moment right there where the president does decide, okay, I'll leave the room.
Well, he was surprised. I mean, the people who were there said he looked like he was really unhappy. And I know I've covered presidents for 42 years and have read a lot of history, know of no incident in which the president was voted off the island in his own house.
Yeah. As you said, you've covered a lot of presidents. How different is this White House than the ones you've written about before?
Well, first of all, you've got to understand, and I think this is critical, that Obama wants to solve these problems. He is a reformer at heart, I would argue. As I report in the book, in lots of moments, he tells people he's a fiscal conservative, a so-called blue dog, meaning he's somebody who wants to balance the budget. He told me he would, and this is a quote, he said, I would willingly lose an election if I could solve this problem of the federal debt and deficit in the right way, in a way that would be long-lasting. But he did not find a way to put it over the top.
Some of the folks who've reviewed your book in the past couple days had criticized it for not focusing more on the intransigence of the Tea Party in all of this. And you say at the end, you conclude that, and I think this is a quote, Obama could have worked his will on this issue. Do you really think he could have given the Tea Party?
I mean, he should have, but it's hard. And I also say that Speaker Boehner is responsible for this impasse because he did not have a kind of once-in-a-lifetime conversation with Eric Cantor, his deputy. Cantor, very much a much more conservative, aligned with the Tea Party, didn't kind of sit him down and say, we need one leader here. you or me.
Yeah.
And so there is a war going on in the not just between the Democrats and the Republicans, but there's an intense war going on in the Republican Party.
Do you think
the presidents get difficult assignments, and if you think about it, World War II, it almost looked at the beginning like an impossible task to win. Franklin Roosevelt figured out a way to do it. Presidents have solved problems. This problem has not been solved, and it looms like a hand grenade with the pin pulled in our economy. Everything depends on the ability of the U.S. government to pay its bills, to finance its debt. In fact, in one of these meetings, Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, points out that the United States, because of the authority and the confidence people have in Treasury securities around the world, some now $16 trillion of those, because of that trust, the United States is single-handedly propping up the Western financial system. To put that in jeopardy puts the whole American economy, the whole global economy, potentially in jeopardy.
Let me go back just briefly to this
this
issue about, you know, working a president working his will on an issue of national importance like this. Do you think a President Clinton could have worked his will on the issue if he had had to deal with the Tea Party?
Don't know, but if you go, I did a book on the Clinton presidency, the first year, book called The Agenda, and he worked out a plan, and now he got only Democrats to support it, and it passed the Senate 50-50 with Vice President Al Gore breaking the tie, but that was an economic plan, a deficit reduction plan that included spending cuts and some tax increases.
You end your book on a very pessimistic note, saying these Washington leaders were risk-averse. There was so much effort, so little result. House Speaker John Boehner just said today that he wasn't confident at all that Washington would be able to avoid the looming fiscal cliff that we've been talking about that may happen in January. What do you think? Do Americans have any reason for optimism that we can avoid that?
Quite frankly, I'll answer your question. I think it's kind of shocking that this isn't discussed in the presidential campaign. It's probably the most important piece of business. The new president, whoever it is, whether it's Obama or Romney, they are going to face this. They're going to have to do something about it. And we can't have more wreckage. I mean, I had not heard Boehner's comment, but there he is, and he's a key participant in all of this, saying we're not sure we can do it. You know, again, I want to rely on Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, who's quoted extensively in the book at these closed-door meetings, and he says, essentially, you know, this isn't about a budget or some sort of debt ceiling issue. This is about the American economy. And we can, as he points out in one of the discussions, you can shut down the government, but if we default on our debt, you shut down the American economy. And, I mean, you know expertly that if that happens, the impact, as Geithner says, there are no parachutes. The impact would be on everyone. Their bank account, the value of their home, the value of the stocks or investments they have. You could, on a quote, Al Simpson, who was the co-chair of the fiscal commission that President Obama appointed, Al Simpson saying you could start on a Monday and something could throw off the confidence in the U.S. economy, in the ability of the government to fund its debt. As you know, interest rates would skyrocket. People would cut back. Businesses would cut back. More people would lose their jobs. And by Friday, you would be living in an entirely different world. To put this at risk makes no sense. And we ought to have a discussion about the people who want to be leaders of our country in the next 4 years about how they would do this, because if it happens, or if it is threatened to happen again, where we are not going to be able to have the authority to fund the federal government to pay its bills, it would be indelible. And lots of economists and the Treasury Secretary say it would last for generations. And should it happen, it's like virginity. You don't recover it.
Now, I take it you read the review.
So that's pessimistic.
Yeah.
It's fixable also. You know, we've got the economy and the capacity to fix things. But in part, this book is called The Price of Politics, because the politics of it hasn't been solved by the politicians, and they're putting everyone in this country, everyone in the world to a certain extent, in jeopardy.
I've got to ask you, finally, I'm sure you've read some of the reviews of your book, and some of them are saying, well, there's nothing that new here. We've read a lot of this before. What do you say to those people?
Well, I guess they reviewed the book and didn't read it, because it's obvious. We've talked about all kinds of things that are new, and I've learned this in 4 decades of reporting, because somebody wrote a couple of stories about it or tried to figure out what happened. I remember the Vietnam War and Watergate and, you know, the 2008 financial crisis. People keep coming back and adding to our knowledge of those events. You don't get it in the first bite.
Right, right. But is it harder to make a splash with this sort of Inside Washington book now, because there are so many writers and reporters covering it? We all have instant access to what everybody's reporting 24/7 on the Internet. Is that frustrating?
Yeah. But no one interviewed the president other than myself on these topics in depth, where we spent almost an hour and a half going, this happened at this meeting, this was your position, this was what you were trying to do. And to suggest that it's new or not new is ridiculous. There is a lot of detail, and there's a lot of complexity here, but it is, you know, this is the world we're living in, and the cliche is it's a fiscal cliff, but it's also a political cliff, and if something is not done about putting the financial house of the federal government in order, it's just, you know, it needs to be, you can't solve it in a year or 10 years, but you need to put it on a path. And we have a spending addiction, the Congress and the executive branch, that it is a real addiction. And somebody's got to kind of blow the whistle on it and say, let's put political energy and political will to ensure that we stabilize the situation. Because I don't want to be a prophet here and kind of be all doom and gloom. But you talk to any economist, you talk to Simpson and Bowles and their commission, Pete Peterson, who runs a foundation here, about the perils of where we are heading, and it's quite real. And so, in a sense, this book is an intervention, if you will, to extend the metaphor about we are have an addiction for spending, and it's time to wake up.
You mentioned the relationship between Congress and the White House being so rocky. Do you think it's the worst it's been, or has it been worse in other administrations?
Well, no. It gets bad many times. I mean, when the Republican House impeached Bill Clinton in the 90s, obviously the relationship
oh, right.
was not that great.
We forgot about that.
but he was not convicted in the Senate, and he stayed in office. In a sense, the comparisons are hard to make. The problem is, and you identified it, and the book identifies the intransigence and inflexibility of the extreme Tea Partiers in the Republican Party. And the book points out how Republicans were so inflexible on the issue of taxes. They would not raise taxes under any circumstances. At the end, in the deal that kind of postponed everything with what's called the sequestration, right. the Republicans agreed to throw the Pentagon and the Defense Department under the bus and say, yes, they will be subjected to mandatory cuts in defense that Obama's defense secretary, Leon Panetta, said would be devastating.
You mentioned that the candidates are not talking on the campaign trail about this looming fiscal cliff. Why do you think that's so? Why aren't they talking about it?
Because it's complicated and people are under the illusion that somehow this was solved last year. It was solved for 18 months. But the debt limit was extended just past the election. Talk to people at the Treasury Department. It's at some point in January, December of this year, January, February of next year. There's going to be no authority to borrow money to pay the bills that must be paid. And so in a sense, it's kind of like, I guess people think it's complicated. People think it's abstract. If I were moderating one of those debates, I would ask many questions about this and say, what are you going to do? What's your theory of the case? How do we get out of it? If you look at the plans, the very sketchy plans that Obama and Romney have put forward generally about how they would try to balance the budget or improve the deficit, and you dig into them at all, they don't add up. They don't work. They're not explained. They are figments of somebody's imagination. And solving this problem is not going to, it's not a matter of somebody's imagination. It's a matter of hard numbers, and it's a matter of compromise.
And you can't squeeze the answers into a 15-second soundbite on the campaign trail, right?
Well, you can't get close. But I'd like to know, you know, what's the plan for the biggest threat to this country? Not just its economy, because the whole way of life could be put in jeopardy. What's the plan to ensure that we don't go off this cliff? The Congressional Budget Office, which is the neutral arbiter of all of these things, issued a report. It was in the newspapers. It was on television and the radio, saying if we continue on this path, we are going to have a government-created recession. I mean, think about that, the laws on the books now about the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and mandatory spending cuts, we are going to have a government-generated recession.
Yeah.
Astonishing.
So finally, this is your 17th book. What's your 18th going to be about?
Don't have a plan.
No
I hope
plan.
It's not. I hope it's not about, you know, the politicians in Washington finally sunk the ship. I hope that's not the next book.
Yeah. Bob Woodward's new book goes on sale today. It's called The Price of Politics. Mr. Woodward, thanks so much.
Thank you.